Doom's main purpose in life is to destroy the Fantastic Four, and me especially.
Hey there, welcome to Marvel by the Month. My name's Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
Hey Rob, it's the first day of school here in Portland. As I'm sure you're aware of.
Yeah, it's totally aware. I used to walk by a school on my way into work.
But now you can't come within 500 yards of that.
No. Yeah. And it's right by Books with Pictures, but the sound, so I'd be walking into work, always late for a meeting because it's the morning. And the sound of the kids screaming at the playground would waft through my headset and let everyone know. They're like, "Oh, I guess you're parked." And I'm like, "Yeah, thanks everybody." But, so I could tell when school was because of the screaming of the kids. Not the silence of the lambs, man. This all sounds weird now.
Yeah, this is going dark in a hurry. Well, if you ever get nostalgic for that, what you can do is you can come to my dining room now, because my house has been converted into a schoolroom for 4 second graders.
Wow.
Yeah, because that's the times we're living in right now. So
yeah, one wasn't enough. You had to just multiply that.
Yeah, exactly. Just gotta collect them all. So
that also sounds creepy. There's nothing that doesn't sound creepy right
now. Yeah, we could either just stop here, or we could maybe bring someone in who could help us take this in a very different direction,
or worse.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it goes. So we have a guest joining us for this episode. He is the founder and creative director of Action Lab Entertainment, and he is the writer of so many great comics for readers of all ages, including Vamplets for Scholastic, Dark Horse's Jenny Zero, Behemoth's Prom of the Dead, and he's also the creator of the excellent Fanable webcomic Mind Palace, which updates twice a week at mindpalacecomic.com. Dave DeWanch, thank you for joining us on Marvel by the Month.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. Let me tell you, you are on my listen list, but after that diatribe, you guys are on my watch list too.
We're on a lot of people's watch lists. Dave, we first met you back when there was such a thing as comic book conventions. We met you at Rose City Comic Con last year, and we talked classic Marvel comics and comics in general for quite some time, and it was a blast.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, that was the weekend that I scored the Dark Horse gig. So you guys, I think you're my lucky rabbit feet. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's been great. And yeah, I mean, you know, me and Marvel Comics, we go way, way, way back. I mean, not so way back as to 66, which was, you know, kind of what we're talking about today. But, you know, I grew up, I'm pretty old. I'm like 46. So I grew up, you know, late 70s, early 80s Marvel. But it was a treat to go back in time to some of these old books and take a look at what I was missing.
Yeah. Well, and I've also been following, you know, I follow you on Instagram, and you had this great series of Stuff I'm Buying in the Apocalypse posts where you're posting a bunch of just like classic comics. Can you refresh our memory on some of the good finds that you have gotten since we've all been in lockdown?
Oh my goodness. It's been crazy. Like for me, a lot of it's been like a ton of first appearances, a lot of key issues. And this is stuff that like some of it I've had before and some of it I have not. And it was like, you know, I'm sitting around at home and I'm not doing much. I'm just kind of hanging out. And so I started reaching out to comic shops that I knew that were closed.
Yeah.
And I figured I would just make connections and try to pick up books that I wanted and have wanted forever. So recently, picked up the first Mongol, which I had the second appearance, and I know we're talking about Marvel, but I did first appearance of Creeper, done a couple power packs, did some Avengers. I love Squadron Supreme, so I picked up a couple of those first appearances, picked up a first Star-Lord, picked up a Rocket Raccoon. I think it was a Hulk book. But yeah, I've been hitting up a couple shops in the Bay Area. I'm from Northern California. And I have a couple of go-to shops that I like to patronize. I don't patronize them, you silly comic shops. I mean, tons of books. I just picked up, and it's a book I've always wanted, was the first Wolverine.
Nice.
I picked that up with the first installment of Checks from Dark Horse. I was like, that's burning a hole in my pocket. Put that somewhere. And I picked that up from a shop called Cape and Cowl in Oakland, California. And great people, great. You know, the thing about comic shops is the culture.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're your bartenders. You walk in and you're like, I need this to fill this need. And they find it for you, right? I miss it. I worked in a comic shop for like 20 years, you know, and that was my love of comic books. That, my dad working in comic shops, collecting comics, and then moving into like making them, which is the most insane thing you can, if you're a comic book lover, is to just be like, I want to do it. Mm.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's been a long road, but it's been fun. And this last 6 months has been crazy. You know, my short boxes are growing, and my wife's, I have less and less excuses for what I'm doing these days, guys.
Yeah, I think we're all in that boat to greater or lesser degrees. We've got a number of great comic shops here in Portland that I have been trying to, you know, make sure that I'm spreading a little money around.
Single-handedly and keep afloat. Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, I heard this theory kind of at the beginning of the pandemic. It's like, make a short list of the places that you absolutely want to make sure are still around after this thing is over, and be supporting them through everything. So yeah. And we actually caught you while you're, you know, kind of on the road and enjoying some downtime. So thank you so much for making time to chat with us. This is awesome.
Oh, for sure. I'm glad we got this on the books. I'm glad that we got some books to read. That was fun. So I just got, not to plug Marvel, but Marvel Unlimited. I got it just recently. They had a deal I couldn't pass up, and that's how I read these books. And obviously you want to read the books tactile. You want to smell the old paper. You want to feel it. But man, the experience has been really, really good on that app.
Yeah, just having those things at your fingertips. I have something like 27,000 comics in long boxes in my basement. And I'm like, I can find like the annuals, the reprints of the annuals, but I'm not going to go open that thing when I can go boop, boop, you know, just right. Pull it up on the iPad and get to it.
Yeah. The show would be impossible to do if we didn't have something like Marvel Unlimited. Like it would be totally cost prohibitive. And actually it was when Marvel Unlimited first came out, that's when I remember mentioning to Rob, I'm like, there's an app that has like every Marvel comic. We should do a podcast where we read every Marvel comic.
And I was like, that sounds great. And now here we are 70, you know, episodes in, where I'm like, dude, I cannot get through Sergeant Fury this week. I don't know what's going to happen, man, but I don't have time.
How funny. Yeah. That's the thing. I don't know if I would want to do current comics. I think that this is what you guys are doing is the best thing that you could do, because you like we said earlier offline, you get a perspective on the time period that you're researching. You get to go back in time and see where all the groundwork for all this amazing stuff that's happening now started. And you know, for me, I get to see Stan Lee be really kooky, and I think that to move forward, sometimes you have to look at where we've been and how far we've come, right? I think that as a country, we got to do that. So not to get political, but you know, we have to learn from the past. And I think that your podcast is kind of providing that for people. And I love it.
Well, thank you very much. And thank you for giving us a good transition into the next thing that we need to do on this show, which is to talk a little historical context for when these issues came out. So everything that we're talking about today hit the stands in October of 1966. So here's what else was going on in October of 1966. I'm going to start us off with a little news about what the commies were up to. Commies are very big in the mid-60s. So on the 5th of October, North Korea's leader Kim Il-sung delivered a speech to the Korean Workers' Party in which he called on his followers to, quote, wage a positive struggle against U.S. imperialism in the form of limited warfare against the American military presence in South Korea. Almost immediately, there was a surge of provocations at the Korean demilitarized zone, and you could argue that North Korea is still keeping that up to this day. So
that would be a pretty easy argument.
Hey, you know, it's a tradition. occasional group of people.
Yep. And then on the 7th of October, the Soviet Union declared that all Chinese students must leave the country before the end of October. This order came after the communist Chinese government had declared on September 20th that it would cease allowing Soviet exchange students to study at Chinese universities. So the commies cannot get along with each other.
Well, I also have to add that Stan Lee was a big fan of commas.
Yeah.
In his FYI, but yes. We'll get to that.
Yeah. I think he got paid by the punctuation marks. On the 25th of October, the People's Republic of China successfully test fired a nuclear missile for the first time. Yay.
Oh, my God. Setting the seeds for the future.
Yeah. They had an accurate hit and an atomic blast at a predetermined target in the Lop Nor Desert site. Wow. And then 3 days later, obviously feeling pretty cocky, they announced that they were claiming sovereignty over territory within the independent Buddhist kingdom of Bhutan. So they're starting to gobble up territory and setting off nukes and... Boy, that cultural revolution's in full swing.
Thanks for setting me up for not, you know, nuclear blasts. I've got pop culture. So on the 10th of October, the Beach Boys released their hit song, Good Vibrations, their most popular record ever. The song would reach number one on the charts in the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, and Malaysia.
That song is produced masterfully.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's a treat for your ear holes, for sure.
And the whole Pet Sounds album is something everyone should do. Spend some time doing, like maybe while you're just cooped up at home, take some time, hang out with the Beach Boys.
Yeah, Hipster Me has the mono release of it, but I need the stereo sounds, my brothers.
Yes. I have all the Beatles albums, of course, on mono too, and I went through all of them in mono and was like, yeah, I guess I'm okay with not going through that again anytime soon. Just back over to the weird, you know, stereo mixes, so I know when one speaker is out. On the 19th of October, Jon Favreau, the Marvel Cinematic Universe's Happy Hogan and director of Iron Man and Iron Man 2, was born in Flushing, Queens, New York.
Wow. And we'll be talking about him later, sort of.
Yes, we will. Yeah.
On the 27th, the CBS television network premiered It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown. It has been shown annually ever since during the last week in October. So that stuck around as long as the demilitarized zone in Korea. So on the 28th,
that's a great parallel. I'll
take it. It's the 38th parallel.
That's my contention. The comedian and Conan O'Brien sidekick Andy Richter was who played Globby in Big Hero 6, the series, was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the 28th of October.
Shout out to my in-laws in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Dave, we have a few items of note from the Bay Area and California in general, which took place in October of 66. So starting on the 6th, the hallucinogenic drug LSD became illegal in the state of California. It was the first state to ban LSD. And then in 1970, LSD would be reclassified as a Schedule I drug nationwide by the Controlled Substances Act. So... no legal turning on, tuning in, dropping out for California.
How progressive, regressive, and progressive.
I know, right?
What a wild ride.
That's the way it goes. On the 16th of October, 1 year to the day after her first performance for the rock group The Great Society, singer Grace Slick made her first appearance with Jefferson Airplane at the Fillmore in San Francisco. And then on the very same day in Oakland, the Black Panther Party was created by Bobby Seale and Huey P. Newton, who drafted the party's 10-point program with a list of what we want and explanation of the demands under the heading What We Believe.
Wow.
And Seale and Newton chose the name and logo after getting mail from a similarly named organization in Lowndes County, Alabama. And the ghost of Martin Goodman really wants you to know it was not because of the Marvel Comics character. He was very nervous about that.
I'll tell you that. Not to derail the history, but rest in power, Chadwick.
I
don't know when you're posting the episode, but for us, it's very, very recent that Chadwick passed away. And what a mark he's left on the Marvel universe and
yes,
society in at large. So, yeah. so good on you. Big bucket of win for that guy.
Someone was just texting me today about something tangentially related to the Black Panther movie. And then it's like, I remember it's like, oh yeah, he's gone. And then, like, I got bummed out all over again.
Yeah.
Like,
it keeps happening.
Yeah.
So. I mean, I'm trying to put it into perspective and as a minority and someone of color, it's the last person that made this kind of impact on my pop culture brain was like a Brandon Lee. He was the guy that was going to make it okay for us to have an Asian action star. And we were all rooting for him. I mean, like his father was close to be, I mean, he's a legend obviously, but I mean, he was close to breaking that ceiling, but Brandon was like the new hope. And then his life was cut short and, you know, something about infinite potential that's cut short. It's super sad, but when you know that it means so much for everyone, it hits that much harder. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah. But man, he left a phenomenal body of work behind him.
And so, of inspiration. Yeah. Just straight up. He's going to change a generation of people who have seen what he did and who he embodied. You know, he's helping to bring both history and some, you know, 60s comic book history to life. So,
yeah. Right.
Well, man, now I'm super bummed out to do this last bullet on California news from October 1966. But we got to get our true crime listenership up.
Oh, so yeah. Mention true crime every time.
Yeah. 18-year-old Cherry Jo Bates became the first victim of the Zodiac Killer when she was murdered after leaving the Riverside Community College campus library at closing time. So,
wow. The Zodiac, living in the Bay Area, I mean, obviously, like, I grew up in the 70s, but that boogeyman, man, whew. Being in the Bay Area, that is a scary son of a bee. We were terrified. I mean, the Night Stalker later, but fascinating business, you know, with that. And there is a weird romanticization about that killer because he was never caught, man. Yeah. Like, never. I mean, that's creepy.
Yeah.
Yep. He had a costume. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. But, he was a supervillain. Yeah,
for sure. Yep. He looked a little like the Masked Marauder.
Ooh, yes.
Later.
Yes.
Teaser. Nice. Okay, well, let me take us to Washington, D.C. we'll wrap up with this. On the 11th of October, the Child Nutrition Act was signed into law by President LBJ. It supplemented the existing national school lunch program by establishing the school breakfast program for schools in poor neighborhoods. On the 14th, after his return from his tour of South Vietnam, U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert S. McNamara sent a secret memo to President Johnson conceding that the U.S. effort in the Vietnam War was failing, noting that the government of North Vietnam, quote, knows that we can't achieve our goals. The prognosis is bad that the war can be brought to a satisfactory conclusion within the next 2 years. I see no reasonable way to bring the war to an end soon.
But let's just keep throwing young soldiers at it and see what happens.
On the 15th, the day after, President Johnson signed a bill creating the United States Department of Transportation, the 12th cabinet-level department in the United States government. The DOT would begin operations on April 1st, 1967, with Alan S. Boyd as the first U.S. Secretary of Transportation. On that same day, President Johnson signed the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966, creating the National Register of Historic Places that is maintained by the United States Department of the Interior.
It's kind of crazy going back and looking at all the things that Johnson added to the federal government during his time, like so much stuff that we just kind of take for granted now. Like there's the big things like Social Security and Medicare and all that stuff, but also stuff like there wasn't a National Register of Historic Places before he brought it into law. There wasn't like a national federal support for kids to get lunches in school, you know, before he signed it into law. It's very interesting to see society in this the middle of this big transformation.
Yeah, while he's, you know, just throwing bodies at Vietnam.
Yeah, just, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
yeah, it's crazy.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, our last note is on the 29th of October, the National Organization for Women, NOW, was officially incorporated during its first national conference held in Washington, D.C. The organization declared its purpose to be, quote, to take action to bring women into full participation in the mainstream of American society now, exercising all the privileges and responsibilities thereof in truly equal partnership with men.
Rob, you ended that on the best note that you could end it on, because I have notes from these comics. That, wow, that doesn't sound cool at all. So, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. They apparently they were reading some of the female characters that Stan Lee had written, and they're like, you know, we got to put an organization together because this will not stand.
I just think about it. Like, these comics were fairly progressive for the time.
Yeah. And that's the thing is, like, I remember, you know, I mean, in hindsight, everyone says that, right? So going back in time and reading them, I'm kind of like, warning flag, yeah, flag. So what are we doing here, guys? And then, you know, but at the same time, I didn't know if I should feel so bad about dissing, you know, the late great Stan Lee too, because I mean, without what he did, we would have what we have.
It's there's so many things, and as we say to many guests, we often get Stockholm syndrome from reading these every week, where we just sort of forget, like, we don't act like that in our normal life, but when we're reading the comic, it's just like Mad Men. It's just going by us. It's like this. Yeah, of course they're going to say something about the woman's intuition and she's busy shopping or some other slight, and it's just, that's what they do every week that we read these, you know.
Yeah.
But somebody comes on and goes, holy crap, look at what they're doing, and we're like, oh yeah, yeah, I'm sorry, we'll
wake up. Yeah,
that is bad.
Sure.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, so there's October 66 in a nutshell. We're going to take the first break of the episode. When we come back, we're going to talk a little Amazing Spidey here on Marvel by the Month.
Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Let's get into Amazing Spider-Man number 44, written by Stan Lee, art by John Romita. It's called Where Crawls the Lizard. So quick summary is, while waiting at the train station for his family to arrive from Florida, Dr. Kurt Connors starts to transform back into the lizard. The chemicals he used to help Spider-Man stop the Rhino were also part of his original lizard formula, because costume dissolver equals lizard formula.
Because he only knows how to do one kind of chemistry. Same chemistry. It can defeat a rhino, but it could also turn him into a giant lizard man.
So the lizard robs a jewelry store, not because he wants the goods, but because he either wants Spidey to be accused of the robbery, or he wants to get Spidey's attention and lure him into a fight where he can finish him off. Spidey lures the lizard into fighting in public, clearing his name, but the lizard slices through Spidey's web line, causing him to fall and hurt his arm. Now, not only is he injured, but he feels like he can't go out in public as Peter Parker with a busted wing.
I have a question for you guys. So
it
is called Where Crawls the Lizard, right?
Yep.
But my question to you is, where did Aunt May go? They do say that she takes Peter's last $30, right? Today, that's $240.
Okay.
Aunt May go? How long did she go? I think there's some fanfic that needs to be written about where went. Because for $240, his last $240, it's wholly irresponsible for her to do that, first of all. And hopefully she went and, like, maybe went to, I don't know, Reno or Vegas and doubled it, maybe?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I think she is. So she's from Queens. So probably she either went to Atlantic City to try to, you know, double the money, or like every other elderly New Yorker, she went to Florida. Like, that's, you know, that's where your ancient maiden aunt will wind up going.
I would say she probably did go to Florida because she seemed like it was boring. And, you know, at the end of the story, she's relaxed or whatever. I don't think that maybe gambling would relax her very much. I would agree with you. But I just thought, wow, that's pretty cold that she's going to take his last $30.
Yeah.
And I think the $30, I think I remember her saying that it was a down payment on the trip. Like, so this could be like a
European adventure, like she's far from home.
Yeah. Aunt May far from home.
Oh my God. That's so good. Yeah, but I will say this. Can we have John Romita draw that? Because it is beautiful. This issue is one of the prettiest things I've ever seen. I akin it to it's just next level. It's masterful. There's so much cool stuff going on in this issue. And even the quiet scenes are beautiful.
Yeah. Which is I mean, that's what makes or breaks a good Spider-Man story. You've always got the Spidey fights, you know, villain of the week, but it's the supporting cast and it's all the emotional resonance behind it. Like, that's what makes a good Spider-Man story. And I think this is, you're absolutely right, Dave. Like, this is one of them. I mean, like, Kurt Connor's family is the difference between the Lizard and like generic monster baddie. Like, the heartbreak that they're being put through. And then like Spider-Man trying to walk this very fine line between giving them some information, but not too much information. He wants them to have hope, but at the same time, he knows there's not really a lot of hope here, you know? So he's just like, oh man, I don't want to give him the bad news. I don't want to break this kid's heart, you know?
Yeah, and so, as we've said a few times, it's like since Jazzy Johnny Romita took over here, he for Ditko, they're putting everything into this. Like they're not slacking on the stories they're telling or how they're setting up their panels or, you know, it's fine work and it's great for him to just come out like, you know, he's doing a number of titles now and he's just. Yeah. Killing it. Yeah.
I akin it to like, you know, it to put it into context, it's kind of like when John Byrne showed up and you're like, who the heck is this dude? That's just a BA. You're like, what? This guy is just slamming everything he does. And it is that dude for this time period. But not only that, there's an evolution in the characters. Like if you look at, you know, Flash Thompson, who could have been like a throwaway character years ago, right? You see them all sitting around a diner. They're all drawn differently. They all have a unique look and a unique voice. And it's really good to see that evolution of characters when, you know, I mean, comics, for lack of a better term, were somewhat primitive, you know, and to see that growth in these characters is great. And, to me, every single book that we're going to talk about tonight is a Stan Lee joint. And this one is one of the better ones. And he understands that character so well, so much so that it ends on that down note. And it's the down note of Spider-Man. It's like, God, like he can't catch a break no matter what.
No.
You know, I love Ditko stuff too, but let's say Mary Jane, man. I mean, wow.
Like, yeah.
How could you not fall in love with her, right? I mean,
seriously, and she just showed up. The scene with Flash Thompson in the diner. I love that whole scene because it's the first time that Mary Jane and Gwen are in the same place at the same time, and it's a really subtle thing. Like they don't have an exchange, but Gwen is staring at Mary Jane in every single panel, and Mary Jane is very intentionally not looking at Gwen the entire time.
Yep.
And it's subtle, but it's so good. Like it basically is just setting up as like the claws are going to come out at some point.
I was reading that scene and I just have one note from that scene other than the evolution of these characters. I said that Mary Jane is one groovy lamb chop daddy-o. She is like calling everyone dad. She's like, oh, what's up, Peter-o? You know, you just like, wow, what a cool chick. She wants to get on the back of that motorbike. It's not there. Sorry, whatever. You know, we'll take the bus. She's just got an answer for everything and you got to love her for it.
Yeah.
I feel like that liveliness, there's something about it that like, maybe it goes away a little bit when they get older because, you know, then it becomes about like marriage and kids and all that stuff. But here it's perfect. It's perfect balance of everything. It's great.
Yeah, we haven't seen a character that's this outgoing and also going with the flow and hip, you know, like it's the closest thing we've seen is like X-Men when they go into the village and they're, it's like Bobby and McCoy and Hank trying to like hang out with the beatniks doing poetry. That's as close as we get where Stan's idea of what the Hep Cats are up to.
But when she walks in, if you look at the style that Romita threw on her, like the clothing, the hair, like even when she's on the phone later and she's just kind of leaning back and it's just this natural pose, she's like living in this world and every dude wants to date her and every woman would want to be her. And you're just, there's nothing in some of the other books that we're going to talk about, like the women serve as kind of like victims or prizes or trophies where they must be protected or they must be, sought after in some kind of, other way, like they're a prize in some way. Mary Jane sits outside of all that in this, and that's what makes her very unique in this comic book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's a force of nature. And I remember, reading an interview with Jerry Conway years later, where he talked about, like, when he was writing Spider-Man, he was trying to get Gwen Stacy to be the woman that Peter settles down with. And it's like, and he's writing the book and he couldn't make it happen. He couldn't, like, Mary Jane kept stealing every scene that she was in. Like, she just can't not do it. I mean, it's incredible.
I wonder if they knew that they had gold when they wrote her. I mean, obviously it's written with intention, but like, I wonder what the feedback was and whether or not that feedback meant we have to kill Gwen Stacy and we have to like, you know, I mean, not fridge her, you know, like we all know the term. But, you know, at that point, you kind of do have a clear winner of who women want to be and who men want to be with. Right. So it's kind of like, Gwen kind of got pushed away a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Spoilers, by the way. You guys.
Oh, yeah. Don't read too far ahead. Don't get too attached to Gwen Stacy. Can I mention another one of my favorite parts of the story, which is a little bit part and with supporting characters, but it's the bit where Jonah Jameson is woken up in the middle of the night because, you know, Spider-Man's been accused of stealing of breaking into this jewelry store. And he's just like absolutely incensed that his night editor put out a special edition of the Bugle with, you know, Spider-Man accused in daring gem theft on the front page because he has been wrong about this so many times and he's had to eat crow like time and time again.
Yep, that's amazing.
He's like, I'm going to be a laughing stock again. It's like the guy can learn. I mean, he's a very slow learner, but he can learn.
Yeah. Listen, man, and honestly, I was shocked to see it on these pages. Just the fact that, like, you know, you get into a lot of writers get into like a sophomore slump, but like they're just ramping up, man. It's awesome.
Yeah, this is a great time for Marvel.
This
comics.
Is especially in Spider-Man. I think Stan, like I said, that he's picking up Steve Ditko's story up to this point, just a few months ago, and now everything that's just sort of been teased for a year. Like who is the Green Goblin? Are we ever going to see Mary Jane? All these things. He's just like, yep. Just checking them off and moving the story along. And now we've got Flash Thompson, you know, going in for the draft. He's, you know, possibly headed off to Vietnam. And that's sort of adding just a little more dimensionality to his character as well. And, you know, the only character that stays utterly flat is Aunt May, until we get this story about what she did on her vacation. But then we will have some depth. Yeah,
the long lost secret tales of Aunt May. That's awesome. Well, great issue. I love that. I love the cliffhanger it ends on. Like Dave said, I love that, you know, Peter is just being crushed by the weight of the world and all his responsibilities at the end of it. It's like Spider-Man 101. It's just fantastic. So let's go ahead and take a break. And then when we come back, we'll talk about an issue that maybe didn't click quite as well. and we'll talk a little Daredevil when we come back here on Marvel by the Month.
Do you dare?
We'll be right back.
Okay, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. We're going to talk about Daredevil number 23, which was written by Stan Lee, art by Gene Colan, inked by Frank Giacoya. The name of the story is DD Goes Wild, and it's a pretty wild story. Let me give you a quick summary on it, and then we'll dive in and see if we can make some sense of this. So it's got kind of a convoluted backstory, and I'm really underselling that. So there's a new bad guy on the scene, the Masked Marauder, and he has teamed up with the Gladiator. And the two of them have created a new foe called the Tri-Man, which is like some sort of, I guess, android or something that has the abilities of three different gangsters. So it's like the Enforcers, but like all squished into one android. And they're going to try to defeat Daredevil so that the Masked Marauder and the Gladiator can be named the new heads of the Magia. So Daredevil, he beat the Tri-Man last issue in a sort of exhibition bout in front of a bunch of underworld types. And then as the Masked Marauder and the Gladiator teleport Tri-Man back to their lair, Daredevil hitches a ride. So their plan is to steal Daredevil's abilities as well and incorporate them into the Tri-Man, which I guess would then be the Quad-Man. But then Daredevil frees himself and nearly defeats all of his adversaries. And then, wait, we're not done yet. Then the Masked Marauder transports the Gladiator and Daredevil to a replica of the Roman Colosseum somewhere in Europe that has been used as a film set, I guess, where they duke it out in front of the Magia. Gladiator accidentally frees a lion who I guess they left behind in the movie set. And then Daredevil manages to get it back in its cage. So after Daredevil saves his life, the Gladiator is no longer interested in fighting him. And this costs the Masked Marauder his chance to become the head of the Magia. But the Magia Dons are impressed with the Gladiator, so he's got that going for him. Daredevil's free to go, but now he's stuck in Europe with no money and no civilian clothes. What a wild ride.
I don't mean to like jump ahead. I don't want to read the next issue. But do you guys know if Daredevil like has to hitch a ride back from Europe to New York, or is he like...
I can't remember how he gets back, but I do remember that the storyline that comes after it is just about as insane as this one was.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This is when we're about to meet his twin brother. Mike Murdock.
Oh my God.
Is just Matt Murdock. So he's got now two secret. Yeah, it's a whole thing. We'll get to that in an episode.
Is his brother deaf, or is it like any kind of, you know what I mean? Like, I just don't. Yeah. I don't know.
It's like a seven Chinese brothers situation where like each one of them is just like missing a sense.
Yeah. Right. But they're all super BA though. That's I want to say this though. At the beginning of this issue, when Matt is in the exhibition fight with the Tri-Man, and that was in the issue previous, he dresses as Daredevil to throw everyone off the scent that he is truly Daredevil, which I think is the best logic in my entire life. And then like Karen's like, well, but he's blind, so how could he be Daredevil? Well, he's in the suit, Karen. Like, come on. Are you blind? Like, what are you talking about? To me, I just was like, right from get-go, I'm kind of like, where are we going with this? And then, you know, the Colosseum and everything else. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I guess that logic works on people who they think that Trump can't be a white supremacist because he hangs out with white supremacists. So, you know, it's all part of his elaborate cover.
My God. So I have to say that I hate Daredevil's Rogues Gallery. It's like the worst of all of them, right?
It's pretty bad.
So bad. It's so bad.
Yeah, well, because the Kingpin hasn't been introduced in Marvel Comics yet. And that's, and I mean, he comes in as a Spider-Man villain. So the only time that Daredevil has a good villain is when he poaches him from Spidey.
Yeah. Right. Or when one time he fought Namor. That was awesome. But because he just kept getting beat down, but he was just like, nope, I'm going to hold on to your little ankle wing, trying to stop you from going away. And so it was an interesting story. Other than that, like Ant-Man is the only. Ant-Man's Rogues Gallery was so bad that they were good, like Paste Pot Pete and, you know, with Strange, with Johnny Storm.
Do you guys wish that like a Geoff Johns would come in and just take all these old characters and just make them super awesome? Like, that would, I mean, there's, Hey, you know, I've always wanted to write Daredevil. If you got, if anyone at Marvel is listening, I would love to take all of these characters and make them awesome. But like, fun fact, I was like, who is this Masked Marauder? Because I need a context for this, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He was the manager of the office building of Nelson and Murdoch?
Yeah, he's their landlord.
What? Like, he's like the Mr. Furley of villains? He's, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, what are you talking about? Like, it doesn't, yep. It's too much of a coincidence, right? Like, it doesn't, New York's a big city. Do you need him to be your landlord?
Yeah, it's just, I mean, Daredevil, you're absolutely right, Dave. Like, he just has this habit of attracting the worst villains, like the owl, like a crime lord who can glide slightly.
It's like they're all Dick Tracy characters, but then someone said, let's redesign all these, like, you know, Chairface Chippendale characters or whatever.
Yep.
And just like, or like tick villains, yeah. But like make them not, like make them like less cool, yeah, than they
depower do. A tick villain. That's what you're, yeah, doing.
It's just, yeah, it's bananas. I mean, I admire it for its insanity in a way. Like, there's got to be a level of freedom, and mm-hmm, that's what Daredevil was for Stan. Because, you know, if you put this back to back with the Spider-Man book, Stan wrote both, and one of these is really, really, really great, and then, yeah, one is just bananas crazy.
Yeah. I couldn't figure out why the story was so complicated. Like, it's unnecessarily complicated. And like, I mean, you've got like the whole thing with the Tri-Man, and then the partnership with the Gladiator, and then the teleporting to Europe and all this stuff. And honestly, the only thing I could come up with is that Gene Colan just drew a killer cover. And then they were like, okay, we got to come up with a story behind
we've
this.
We've got to get them to this scene. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like he's yeah, the Gladiator, right? He should fight in the Colosseum. Okay. How do we get him there? Yeah. All right.
And I wonder if like, this is a really great example of how the Marvel style of making comics is, it hits and it doesn't hit. And this is, yeah, one where it just doesn't, because like, maybe Stan had a plot and then Gene went and drew what Gene wanted to draw and it got turned in. I mean, like, yeah, one of my notes was if the Masked Marauder, who, by the way, Landlord Marauder, had this teleportation device, why wouldn't he just teleport both of them into space, kill them, and be like, look what I just did.
Yeah.
Giant screen that I also built. And they're like, wow, that screen's 60 inches. That's amazing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's also the 60s, right?
Why even be a landlord if you have a that's one of our other things about villains in general. And in these early days, it's like this guy can invent or pay for a teleportation device.
Yep.
He's a landlord of a building.
But Rob, let me tell you, as a landlord myself, and I like to consider myself a land baron, it's the simple pleasures. It's the most evil thing you could do, and the thing you get the most satisfaction from is raising the rent. So, you're in New York.
True.
It's all a premium, and you're like, yep, your rent's going up $100, but I can't. That's like $350 today because I know, yeah, Aunt May's money.
Yeah.
So. Like, I know that you just raised the rent like $1,000, right? Maybe, yep, that's his thing. He just loves raising the rent.
That's true. I guess that is purely evil. Like, that's solid.
And Dave, ever since you mentioned that you were a landlord, I noticed your mustache is getting longer and twistier at the ends.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I feel like this started out as a story, and then they kind of ran out of steam, and then they just kind of grafted bits of other things onto it, and there's a lot of exposition. Like, I mean, even by 1960s Marvel comic standards, there's a lot of exposition.
I think that explains it. It's improv. It's just the, here you go. I just set you up with this. What are you going to do? How are you going to get, yeah, to the next thing?
Yeah. I think though, like maybe, and you know, Robbie, you're talking about being a drummer and we share that in common. Maybe if you put a really great improv jazz beat behind this issue while you're reading it, you feel like, oh wow, this is like vibrant and kitschy, but trying to get through it and make sense of it maybe isn't the point, right?
Yeah,
maybe,
yeah,
just like, let's just go crazy on some drum rolls here.
Yep. just all fills, right. It's all fills.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there might be another explanation for this, and I just thought of this, which is that, I mean, Gene Colan's relatively new to doing superhero comics at this point in his career. He had a pretty large body of work, but he only started doing superhero comics when he started doing the Namor stories in Tales to Astonish like about a year ago. So, I mean, and So he's been doing Namor. He's been doing Iron Man. So he's been doing 12-page stories. And I mean, the explanation might be that he just didn't quite have the pacing down yet, you know, to like, I mean, this is something, I'm not a comics artist, but I would imagine working in this style, like, it demands a lot of the artist from a storytelling perspective. And if you're used to working in a really compressed formula, and then you now have to fill twice as much space to tell a story, like, I could see where that could be a little trickier.
Could be like a couple seasons of Lost. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with you, because, you know, we're going to talk about another Gene Colan joint a little later, and that was masterfully drawn, whereas this one felt like there was a lot of splashy effects, less backgrounds, and then when the backgrounds were there, they were kind of like, I don't want to say they were phoned in, because this is Gene Colan, and it's Gene Colan is a god, but compared to the other story, it is just not quite there. And like a lot of it doesn't make sense. It's you know, this teleportation device where I just couldn't figure out how any of it really worked. Whereas the other one, I got a really good semblance of how reality works for Iron Man. Right.
Yeah, totally.
It doesn't work for Daredevil either. I think that, you know, like, you know, we get hindsight's 2020 and we know where Daredevil is now. And that's a street level character. You would never do any of this with Daredevil now.
Right. Right.
But, you know, here in the you know, they had 22 issues before this to get it right, and they didn't get it right in this one.
Also, the one thing about the teleporter, just since we've talked about it this much, it has to suck them up. Like, there has to be, they get sucked up. It's like the, what was that hair, you know, like the reverse hair dryer that also cuts your hair? It's like a Flobee. It's like a Flobee teleporter. Like, why the extra... massive suction that you need to generate first to get them up into this tube. I don't know. It's just, I'm going to get way in the weeds on the teleporter if we stay here much longer, but
yeah. So, well, why don't we take a break and then switch gears and talk about the Iron Man story that Dave was just talking about, because that is a really good example of some awesome Gene Colan stuff.
I'm going to use a word that I've never used before. Noise.
All right. We will be right back here on Marvel by the Month.
Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Let's go to Tales of Suspense number 85, written by Stan Lee, art by Gene Colan with Frank Giacoa. This is called Into the Jaws of Death. So first we have Happy Hogan wearing the Iron Man armor to protect Tony Stark's secret identity. He's been captured by the Mandarin. Mandy has no problem overwhelming Happy, who's unfamiliar with the armor. But Tony gets to work on a new and improved version of the armor and flies himself to China after just checking himself and out of the hospital. He fights his way through the Red Army and the Mandarin's defenses to arrive just in time to save Happy from being executed, setting up a showdown with the Mandarin for next issue. That's it. That's the setup for this. So, you know,
I really like the structure of this one, because I mean, it's basically, so you get the two parallel storylines. It's like, is Happy going to survive long enough against the Mandarin? And then Tony is like, I got to get out of this hospital. I got to build myself new armor, and then I got to get to China. So you got like the ticking clock thing, and it's, you know, it's all about how long can Happy hold out and how fast can Tony move? But the opening splash page, I think, is actually really effective. Like, talking about some dynamic Gene Colan artwork here, it's like you've never seen the Iron Man armor just getting absolutely shredded. And you kind of realize, like, maybe for the first time, like, this is the power of the Mandarin. Like, he's got all these abilities, and he's literally just taking chunks of the armor off. So it's like you kind of realize, like, well, Iron Man has been pretty lucky to survive this far against him. And now it's Happy Hogan. He has no idea what he's doing. He's just trying to save his boss.
Yeah. You also get this cool, it's just stuff he wasn't doing that much. I guess there were a few things like this in Daredevil, but there's, he puts the camera, you know, the viewpoint on the ground just for these crazy like the cab is pulling up to let Tony out at Stark Industries, and it's just super dramatic scene just because of where he chose to draw it from. And then he does other just insane things with panel breakdowns on page five, like it's Tony running into the lab. So he's just making these, could be fairly mundane, but he really makes the action seem just heightened by the way he breaks up the page. So it's,
you know, it's interesting that you say that too, because I thought it was a different inker, because the panels were set up differently. The inking style was just a little bit toothier. Like it felt like grittier in a way that like you get accustomed to with Gene Colan stuff later. So I was like, is this a different inker? And then I went back and looked and it was the same dude. And so like, you know, again, Brian, to your point, I feel like maybe he spent more time on this, or he's just more comfortable in that space. But yeah, it felt way more real. And to me, of all of the stories that I read, that all of them were Stan Lee, I also felt like Stan Lee had an idea of what this technology was supposed to be, as opposed to the Daredevil thing where I'm just like, oh, that's all a bunch of hoo-ha, you know, like any sense. At least this made perfect sense to me in the context of this story.
Yeah. And that page five, as Tony's, you know, working on the armor and everything, like, I think this is the best visual representation of a montage that we've seen in a Marvel comic so far. Like, because there's no like hard panel border. There's some panel borders, but it's really just kind of like these fragmented images and like just a collage of, you know, of a bunch of different scenes. So you're not seeing like, it's not just like boxes in a grid, but it's sort of like the sense that all this stuff is kind of jumbling together and taking place simultaneously.
Yeah, like a staccato. It just, it has a different flow and a rhythm to it. It's great.
Totally. And then when he gets the new armor at the end of page six, and like, it's just, again, camera's placed really low. Shadows are very dramatic. Giant sound effect. You just get the sense of like, okay, this now, he even says like, where do you say it's like twice as powerful as his previous armor. So, and you get a sense of that, he's going to need it because now he's got to get all the way to China.
I have a question on that too. And this is probably a dumb question because I haven't read a lot of old Iron Man stuff. I was like never really an Iron Man fan, I don't see him flying in this, but he uses a rocket sled to get to China. And I was kind of like, does he not fly right now? Because he's got this new armor. And I just thought, oh, wouldn't this be a rad way to unveil that this armor can fly if he wasn't flying previously? But I don't know the context.
He does fly. He just doesn't fly if it's that large of a distance. That's the same thing with FF. They're like, we can take our normal fantastic car, or we jump in like the missile satellite rocket and the pogo plane and go shoot over to another continent.
I think I'm spoiled by some of those Marvel movies where I'm just like, they can get anywhere in the universe now, right? Yeah. Weird hexagon teleporty thing, you know?
Yeah, they did away, it much like Star Trek, they just sort of did away with all of the problems of distance and time.
Right. Okay, yeah. Cool. That makes sense. Yeah, because at first I was like, why is this guy on a sled? But by the way, am I the only one that wants Happy Hogan, John Favreau Happy Hogan, to actually get in the armor? That would be so awesome if in the next Spider-Man movie, Favreau puts the armor on and becomes Iron Man. I would love it.
It would also be hilarious. Like, whatever they would have him do, or have, you know, he would direct himself doing, it would be like awesome. And just, you know, he's going to say some great lines when he's doing it.
That's the thing. I really, really, really loved the last Spider-Man movie. It was different. It was fun. Mm-hmm. It wasn't what I expected it was going to be. And I love Favreau as Happy Man. He's just so fun. And I think he loves being there. When he shows up to work, he shows up to work and to play.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
He's great. And seeing like Happy in this regarding, you know, again, I wasn't a big Iron Man fan. I didn't have much context for what Happy Hogan was. And I don't think we get that much in this story as to who Happy Hogan is. But we know that he would live and die for his boss. And I kind of love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much all I need to know about that guy.
And he's changed a lot in Gene Colan's version of him. He used to look like a palooka with like big cauliflower ears. Like, and just
like a Favreau.
Yeah, yeah, a little more like Favreau's version. Yeah. So he's gotten a little prettier in this version, but you know, the same character there. He's always like the, you know, defensive, very like ready to rumble, sort of like little hints of Ben Grimm in there.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
Yep.
How fun.
So the other story in this issue, the Captain America story, is also one that I loved for different reasons.
Yeah. So this one is written by Stan Lee, art by Jack Kirby, this time with Frank Giacoa inking. It's called The Blitzkrieg of Batroc.
So you know already it's going to be
yes.
Great.
Oh, man. So the quick summary of this is Batroc kidnapped Cap's S.H.I.E.L.D. girlfriend. So we still don't know the name that it's Sharon Carter. Handed her over to Hydra to lure Cap into a one-on-one fight. He wants to avenge his loss to Cap from their meeting, but when the fight starts going Cap's way, Hydra abandons their vow not to interfere and shoots at Cap. This turns Batroc against Hydra, and he helps Cap rescue the S.H.I.E.L.D. agent and beat up Hydra along the way. So this is like, again, like the Daredevil story. The villain turns to fight with the hero against the larger organization, but this time it's cool. And
yeah, this is such a simple story. And I mean, so many of these early Marvel comics, less is just more. And especially when you have Kirby doing the art, like we just want to see Kirby drawing some guys knocking the hell out of each other. So just give us that, you know, give us a good premise for that and then let them go to work.
I love that because there's a scene in that where Stan has a caption where he's like, whoa, I'm talking too much. Just look at all this artwork. And he shuts up.
Because yeah.
Like every panel has words on it, right? But then he's like, whoa, check this out. And then it's bang, 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 bang. He's like, yeah, I told you. And like, well, when is that normal in a comic book? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yep.
The king, you know, he's like, hey, here's a bass solo. And yep. You're like, what? Okay. Here he is. He's just playing the bottom, man. And you're like, wow, that's awesome that he did that. But also, I have to say, the fight scene was pretty awesome. I mean, it's all fight pretty much.
Yeah.
But, you know,
yeah.
Their story.
Yeah, there's very little story here. I mean, it's basically, but the story elements we get just enough to really make it interesting. I mean, Batroc is such a fun villain. So we've only seen him twice so far. We had, I don't know if you know Sean Baby, but we had him on as our guest when Batroc first appeared, and he just had a blast describing all the action. I really love the way he's fleshed out here, even though there's not a lot of story. It just really drives home the point that, like, he's such a fun guy. He, like, the French words being dropped into the dialogue, like his invincible arrogance and confidence, and the fact that he is, like, he's a man of his word. You know, he's got this code of ethics. He all he wants to do is just beat Captain America out of a sense of pride. And when Hydra interferes with that, like, they have lost his support. Like, he's like, no, you ruined this for me, and now I'm going to kick your ass.
Right. I'm going to keep my down payment. Don't care about the rest. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're done.
I in my notes, I love Batroc so.
Yes.
If I ever wrote him, I'd feel like a racist. Like, I couldn't do it. I couldn't.
Yeah.
I also, like, there was something that he says in there, because I took French in high school. And he says nom de chien like twice. And
yeah.
I don't know what nom de chien means. So I put it into a French to English translator and it came back. And the words that came back were just dog name.
What?
Did he just say son of a bitch?
Yeah.
Is that what that is? Because it just came back dog name. But I love the fact that he just screams dog name twice in this. it's so great.
I grew up about 2 hours from Quebec and I took a bunch of French and like Canadian, especially French Canadian slang is very, very strange. There's a lot of a lot of French Catholicism, mixed into it, but yeah, like nom du chien. And, it's, it doesn't make sense literally. Like, all the best cuss words don't make sense if you just literally say them. But yeah, if you were to call someone that, you would get into a fight in Montreal.
Okay. So I imagine that Stan Lee is scouring you know, the bars in Canada to just research Batroc and into bar fights, and then writes this story. Where I'm going with that. That's little fanfics and Stan Lee stuff. I love it.
Yeah. And you know, I hear you when you say, like, you would feel like a racist if you wrote Batroc. I can't tell if Batroc is the worst stereotype of French people or the best stereotype of French people. Like, he could be both at the same time.
Let me tell you. Depending on which side of the coin you flip, you're a racist.
Mm-hmm. Based on the caricature that is Batroc, though, I also, my mental you know, sort of dialogue for him is Peter Sellers as Inspector Clouseau.
Yes.
And because I've watched the Pink Panther movies too many times, and these are timely. Like, Pink Panther, the movie was out in 63. There was the Return of the Pink Panther, I think, was like 64 or 66. Like, there's a bunch of little Pink Panther things, so I'm thinking maybe that is where Stan Lee is getting his references, just to be even more racist.
That, like, makes perfect sense. Yeah, yeah. He did not leave his home for that. He made it to the theater, but that's it. I like it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. When did the Pepe Le Pew cartoons come out? Because, I mean, that's like, that might be the only character who's more French stereotypical than Batroc.
By the way,
I think Stan is in on his own joke, because in the middle of this script, Cap is fighting him, and the sickest burn ever is Cap saying, "Who gave you your English lessons, Dr. Doom?" And then he's like, "No, you're worse than Dr. Doom." It's like, from what I remember, you're worse than Dr. Doom. So, like, Stan is just off the chain on this one. He's just going,
yes.
I love it. It's so good.
Yeah. Pepe Le Pew has been around since 1945.
There you go.
So, yeah.
Wow.
Yep. Batroc. Can't get enough of this guy.
I've really have been surprised about how much I love him. I mean, I've loved him in, like, Gwenpool and recent, you know, Marvel comics, where he comes in and he's still very similar sort of comic relief, but also this ethical villain guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he hasn't changed a lot over the
years. You know what it did too? It made me wish that they had done more with him in that in Cap 2.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or they just kind of do the face off and it's cool. Mm-hmm. But man, they didn't kill him. They could bring him back, and that would be really awesome to bring him.
I hope the next phase of the Marvel Cinematic Universe just revolves around Batroc.
Yeah.
Oh, there it is. MODOK and Batroc. Batroc and MODOK. Yeah, yeah. They just hate each other, but they have to work together. I love it.
All right. Well, let's take one final break, and then we will talk about the last issue we're going to be discussing, Fantastic Four, number 58. Stay tuned. We'll be right back here on Marvel by the Month. All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. We've got one issue left to talk about this episode. It's Fantastic Four number 58, written by Stan Lee, with art by Jack Kirby, inked by Jolton Joe Sinnott. This one is called The Dismal Dregs of Defeat. So here's the quick summary, and then we'll dig into it. So the story opens with the image of Dr. Doom appearing in a freak electrical storm outside of the Baxter Building. If you remember from the last issue, Doom has stolen the Silver Surfer's power cosmic, and he's ready to start messing with the FF now. When Doom attacks, Ben tries valiantly to fight him off, but he's just as outmatched as he was against the actual Silver Surfer a couple issues ago. And Doom turns him into a statue in Central Park. Doom then takes the fight to Reed and Sue inside the Baxter Building, which Johnny interrupts as he returns to look for something to unfreeze Ben. Doom takes down Johnny without much of an effort, and Reed recognizes that the Fantastic Four have no chance against the cosmically powered Doom. But because he says this out loud in front of Doom, Reed buys them some time. He gambled that Doom would be so delighted by their humiliation that he would let them live. So Doom flies off, and Reed vows that the FF will never give up. This is a barn burner of an issue. There is a lot of just cosmicness left, right, and center.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like classic Doom, but it's like this up level Doom is so cool. There's so many panels too. I can't there's a panel on page 6, panel 4. It's just Doom striking this sort of cool pose and sticking his hand, you know, his fist up and his hand out. I don't know. But it's like, I have that, just somebody did like a black light poster version of that I got in Seattle. That's down in my, you know, like practice space, just because it's so cool. And that's just a throwaway panel in this issue.
Yeah.
It's so cool. Other than the fact that every time Wyatt Wingfoot shows up, I like hold my breath that they're not going to do something even more dumb. Again, speaking of racism, but it's like they didn't do too much in this issue. He just wasn't there that much. But I mean, whenever it just gets into that weird caricature again, and I'm like, come on, guys, just let him.
Don't have him talking about his ancestors, please, just for once. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I, again, like Iron Man, I wasn't a big Fantastic Four fan back as a kid. I always just thought they were like, you know, like your father's superheroes.
Yeah, sure.
But I didn't feel that with Wyatt this time, for sure. And because I don't have context on how they treated him previously or after this, I felt like he was pretty acceptable. But I will say, one of the coolest things ever is Dr. Doom on a surfboard.
I know.
Shut up. God, that's awesome. I almost wish that there was just more of that. Like, I want more of Kirby drawing Doom on a surfboard.
The last issue when he first... has stolen the power from the surfer, and he's just on the board sort of tormenting people, probably in Latveria, knowing Doom, you know, just testing it out, doing a run on some peasants. He's just flying there.
Chasing sick waves on those peasants.
And he just looks so gleeful as he's just like blowing stuff up. It also ends in a classic, Fantastic Four way, like where just, to like let the villain feel like he won. Reed's like, remember when Reed like made Doom think he won for like a year? Like Doom left them alone because he made him think he won. And so he just goes, just let Doom feel like he won and he'll probably not kill us. And that's what he does. And it's just a classic Fantastic Four move. It's not.
I'll tell you though, this is part 2 of 3 or 4? Or
yeah, it's part 2 of 4. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'll tell you, of all of the books that we read for this month, this was the one that I was like, I'm going to read the next one because, Doom on a surfboard. But I mean, if you take a megalomaniac like that and give him power cosmic, what is going to happen?
Yeah.
I mean, this is the kind of thing that makes like an Avengers Endgame, you know? Yeah. It's that big, right? And so reading it and watching it unfold, I was like, man, I'm hooked on this one. This is great. It was no Daredevil issue for me. I'm glad you guys picked this one as the end because I'm like, man, the art kicks. Joe Sinnott.
Yes.
On the inks, man. Kills it. He does something to Kirby's, you know, some of Kirby's stuff. I don't want to say it looks awkward, but it doesn't look as natural as when Sinnott inks him. And man, I was hooked on this one.
You
know, I think the most unbelievable thing might be that they make, Doom makes the thing into a statue and then a couple walks by and they're like, look, a statue. I'm like, what statue with the thing just hanging out in the park, guys? Come on. Like, what world do we live in where that's common, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sinnott as Kirby's embellisher he just brings something out that you don't see from other artists. There's a lot of folks who can ink Kirby just fine. There's a couple who actually take away from what he has to offer, but like Joe Sinnott and Mike Royer are basically the two guys who, when they ink him, it's amazing. There's so much like just cosmic crackling of energy.
The Kirby crackles are everywhere. Yeah.
Seriously. Like, I feel like he got paid by the crackle. it just really gets across this whole idea of like, it's operating on a cosmic scale. This is not Daredevil fighting in a boxing ring. This is not, you know, Spider-Man, you know, fighting in the sewers. This is, you know, it's not life or death. It's like is reality going to survive or not? And it's, and Kirby totally sells it.
And Stan has a very clear vision of who the Fantastic Four are. I will say that I never really liked Reed Richards, and this issue, you know, there was a little bit of that too, where he's like, you know, I've got to protect Sue from the emotional stress of Dr. Doom potentially being cosmic. And so I'm going to take her on vacation, but while I'm there, all I'm going to do is work. And I'm like, bro, like, what are we doing now? Like, if you love your wife and you want to care for her, but don't pretend like, you know, just don't take it as an opportunity to go do stuff. I know what that's like because I do that stuff all the time. I don't like seeing myself reflected in art. That's terrible. What a terrible idea.
Especially the jerkiest version of Reed Richards. He's been not, I mean, he's like getting lighter now. Like, he was saying the worst stuff for about a year, especially right as they got married. And he is, and also like Sue is, the second time they met the Mole Man, Sue saved them all. Like, as she got her force field powers and figured that out, she saved them a number of times now. And it's like, you got to remember that she's one of the big powers of your group. Yeah. You know,
I mean, they mention Johnny Storm's powers in this, and how if he did go supernova, he would kill everybody in the hemisphere or whatever. And I agree that that's a huge power that, and you know, but I think Sue is just as powerful.
Yes.
Yeah.
Than the Thing. She could create a bubble in someone's brain and just expand it and you'd all be dead. It doesn't matter if they have a force field. She can create that anywhere. So like, she really is. And they've gone to great lengths to make her that character later. And kudos to Marvel for doing that.
Yeah.
But here, you know, I didn't wince nearly as much as I had in the past when reading Fantastic Four. So, you know,
yeah. I feel like this one, she's just kind of ignored rather than like actively deprecated, which I guess is well, a win.
At least she has a first name, because like, I was waiting for them to tell me that Sharon Carter was the person that was being held captive in that Tales of Suspense. It never got that satisfaction, which is that's really rough, you know.
Clea in Doctor Strange, how long was that, like 18 months or something?
Yeah, like 18 or 20 name. Months yeah before we finally got her name.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know why it's a Marvel thing from this era where they just introduce female characters and don't name them for a year and a half.
Which makes you feel even worse. Like, it's like she's gonna, like, now, like, what we know now about fridging and about how the lack of agency with female characters, you're like, not naming it is like getting the hamster that you don't name, you know, or the goldfish. Right. It's like, oh, they're going away.
Well, you know, you're going to get to it, like, you know, I don't know, 15 years from now, where, you know, Wolverine is the best that he does at what he, you know, he's the best at what he does, and what he does isn't very nice every single issue.
Yeah,
that's true.
You're going to hear that guy's name way too much, right? We're in the middle is where we need to be in our writing.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Exactly. I think when we get to John Byrne in the Fantastic Four, for sure. I mean, probably before that too, but you know, my Fantastic Four was John Byrne's, because it was the same big ideas with solid art and, you know, still that crackle. But, you know, and not to say that a lot of that, I mean, some of that is, you know, a little rough too. Mm-hmm. But here I didn't feel like it was, you know, it wasn't the worst sexist Fantastic Four I've ever read.
Right. Yeah.
And it also had Dr. Doom on a surfboard. So like, you know,
five
of me is just freaking out about that. So,
yeah. And, you know, for as much of a jerk as Reed can be, I really do like the way that he basically got them out of hot water at the very end. And it wasn't because he like used his super genius brain to whip up some invention. And he doesn't even really win. He just doesn't lose. And he realizes all I got to do is not lose. And he does it by, he just plays Doom. It shows that he's not just a scientific genius, but he actually totally understands who he's dealing with here. It's like, he knows that Doom just can't conceive of anything worse than admitting someone else is better than you. So he's like, well, if I do this for Doom, he's going to think he's just done the worst thing ever to me by forcing me to admit that he's better than me. Whereas Reed's like, I don't care. Like, I'm not a captive of my own vanity, you know, like, and so he's totally willing to sacrifice his pride. It just doesn't mean anything to him relative to, you know, the lives of his friends and his family. So he's like, oh yeah, you're totally the boss, dude. Like, take off on your surfboard. And you know, it buys him the necessary time. And
the other thing, so Doom with ultimate power, terrifying, like he's got cosmic power. But what really is defeats him is his lack of imagination. If your imagination is the power and you're a creative person, you can do so much. But Doom like literally makes the mace weapon that Silver Surfer made last issue to show him that he could make it with cosmic power. He just does the same thing. So he just can't imagine and what he can do with this power other than make everybody kneel. You know, it's just not, and it's not really filled in the story. This is just me sort of writing my own essay on it, but it's like that limitation of Doom, not only is vanity, but it's imagination.
I really like that. And I hope that when they roll into these characters that they're listening and they take that to heart, because I think that is a really good difference between Reed and Doom, right? I mean, they run parallel, much like a Luther and a Superman, right? But one has compassion and one doesn't, right? So like you've got two people that like run together and then they just deviate so sharply. It would make a lot of sense for that to happen in you know, future Marvel pictures or whatever. But yeah, I mean, it's really great.
There you go. $600,000, Marvel, and it's all yours.
hey, Marvel, I got this thing. It's this character called Dr. Doom.
let me sell your own thing back to you.
I love it. It's your thing, but better.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, while we're waiting for Marvel to call us back, let's go ahead and draw this episode to a close. The last thing we do is just talk about our panels of the month. If there was a panel that jumped out at us that really stuck with us after we closed the issue. And I'll go first. Mine is from Fantastic Four number 58. It's page 17, panel one. So there's a lot of, you know, cosmic crackling going on in this issue. And I really probably could have chosen a number of different panels, but the one I chose is after Johnny has just blasted Doom with everything he's got, and Doom is just standing tall in the middle of his flame. You know, he's just looking completely indifferent to everything that Johnny's throwing at him. I just thought it was a very striking image where you've got Johnny's poised to throw a fireball, but he's kind of like crouched down in the corner of the panel, and Doom is just dominating, you know, with his arms akimbo at his sides. It's just a great illustration of, you know, the strength and the power, and there's no background. It's all crackles and flames.
That's putting him over big time with the cosmic power. Well, mine is same issue, page 12, a little bit earlier in the story, when Doom goes to the cottage to mess with Reed and Sue. He ties up Reed and Reed breaks free. And then there's just this panel. It says page 12, panel three, right in the middle of, it's a full width panel. Doom's just been knocked back and he's kind of leaning back on his hand, on one hand, but he shoots this blast with his other hand. And then Reed makes one of his famous like weird plastic man things where he's like a circle. He's like a wheel. But just the staging of this thing is like Reed in a wheel circle with the blast shooting through and blowing up some machinery in it, and Doom leaning back. So he's just sort of getting up, and something about the way this was laid out was another thing like that Captain America issue with Kirby, where I'm like, he just staged this beautiful fight scene that said so much in just one panel, where you just instantly understand it so easily. It's like watching somebody do ballet where it looks easy, and then you try to bend like that and you fall over, or skateboarding, you know, tricks, you know, it's just like, I can do that. Nope. I just ripped all the skin off my arm, but, that's what it looks like. You just gloss over because it looks so, it just elegant and seamless, and it's just part of the story. And I realized, like I do a lot with these panels, like I get done with all the reading and then I go look at the covers of all these books and go, which one, there's something from somewhere that stuck out with me. What was it? And that was the panel. So I just went back to it. Yeah.
You mind if I throw one in there, guys?
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right. So I got Amazing Spider-Man. It's page 10, panel 2. And it's really subtle, no action. It's just the gang. It's the Spidey gang at the diner. And Mary Jane and Peter are about to leave. And she's straightening his jacket, straightening his tie. And, you know, the boys are looking at him kind of jealous. He's looking reluctant, like Peter Parker and Spider-Man always are. And then you've got Gwen just kind of glaring there at him. And I don't think at this point she realizes that she's jealous, but she's kind of letting the love of her life kind of slip away.
Yeah.
And flashier and confident. And everyone else is kind of like, wow, who is this new Peter Parker? And I kind of love it. And you see in his face that he's like, maybe I am that new Peter Parker. You know, like I'm somewhere between Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield, but I'm also likable. So
best of all worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. So really, really quiet moment. And I feel like Romita just nailed it. Just really super honest artwork.
Absolutely. Great choice and great books. I had a lot of fun reading all of them. They weren't all, you know, Hall of Fame candidates, but
Daredevil.
Yeah. And I had an absolute blast talking with you, Dave, about all of these. You've been a wonderful guest. I really appreciate you making the time to chat with us.
Oh, God, it's been a lot of fun and a long time coming. I mean, it's been a while since we first met and touched base and I'm you guys made time for me. It's been fun.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Where can people find you on the internet and what can we plug for you?
America's Most Wanted list. I do that weekly web comic. It's called Mind Palace. You can find me at mindpalacecomic.com. You know, I'm on Instagram and Twitter. It's just at Dave DeWanch. And you know, look for that Dark Horse book, Jenny Zero, to come out in April of next year. It was supposed to come out like in the middle of COVID, and thankfully they pushed me back. We were trying to get out before San Diego this year because we were like, we're going to make a big splash in San Diego.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. And they pushed us back, and I'm very happy to be in the spot we're in.
Nice.
But yeah, I mean, find me all over the internet. It's just look for Dave DeWanch.
Excellent. And you can find us at marvelbythemonth.com. Instagram is our favorite social media channel. That's at marvelbythemonth. And you can drop us an email or send us a voice memo, marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. Rob, anything else we want to mention before we tell these good people good night?
No, I think we're good right now. You know, we still have, you've already flashed the face mask with the Marvel by the Month logo on Facebook and Instagram. So, you know, go to our shop too. I'm always willing to throw those ones in there. Buy some stuff from us. It will, it will fund our comic habit. It will get some lucky person on eBay to sell some action figures or comic books to Brian or I.
Nice.
There you go. I think that's pretty much it. So for Marvel by the Month, my name is Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
And we will see you next week for next month.